The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is from the books section of the magazine, The Three Magic Words I Finally Told My Mother. The author of The Covenant of Water, Oprah's Book Club's 101st selection, shares how he connected with his mother in a way that surprised them both. My parents moved to Palo Alto in 2009, when they were in their 80s. Their apartment was close enough for my younger brother and me to see them often. I'd drop in two or three times a week, and I'd call every day. Once, when I was finishing a call to Mom, my partner, Carrie, nudged me and mouthed the words, "Say I love you, Mom." I didn't. After hanging up, I explained to Carrie that such overt expressions of affection were avoided in our Indian culture. I don't think I'd ever heard my parents say those words. Sure, Mom hugged and coddled me as a child, but "I love you" just wasn't in the vocabulary. They expressed their love over the years by caring and providing for us, by giving us rich and varied experience, and by setting an example. Mom was the extrovert, always chatty, and with many stories to recount, a counterpoint to my often silent father. But she was also the disciplinarian. When you triggered her temper, watch out. I think one of my earlobes is longer than the other from her twisting it, a typical Indian manner of corporal punishment that is less painful than it is humiliating. Not that her actions weren't understandable. I tested her limits, climbing things I wasn't supposed to. I still have a long scar down the inside of my right thigh from sliding down the metal drain pipe outside our two-story apartment building like Zorro. She had grown up in Kerala, South India. Within the generally conservative Indian culture, the St. Thomas Christian community was even more reserved and chaste. The women, wearing a shapeless blouse and a mundu, the latter with a hand-pleated fan tail tucked behind to conceal the buttocks or any hint of them. In addition, she had lived a life of challenges. Mom completed a master's degree in physics, an unusual accomplishment for a woman in the 1940s. She moved first to Sri Lanka to teach for a few years, and then traveled 2,400 miles in a continent away to Ethiopia to teach physics when she was barely 28 years old. She had emigrated to America in her early 50s, where she taught school in New Jersey. Those challenges made her confident, strong, and adaptable, but the imprint of her own upbringing kept her from being vulnerable or sharing confidences with her children in the way parents might in America. By the time of her move to Palo Alto, she had mellowed into a sweet old lady, a doting grandmother. When Carrie and I visited, she greeted us as if we'd been gone for ages instead of 2 days. We'd sit on either side of her on the sofa watching Jeopardy, and Mom would quietly slip her hand into ours. Her hand felt tiny in mine, like a fragile bony bird, or like kindling. She was always sad to see us go. I never doubted she loved me. She felt no need to say it. On another call with Mom, Carrie nudged me again and mouthed, "Say I love you." This time I did. "I love you, Mom," I said. There was an awkward pause, then a giggle. Then Mom said, "Thank you, Macaulay." Macaulay is a term of endearment for a child in Malayalam, the language of Kerala. I could tell she was pleased, and from then on I said it after every call. Always got a giggle and a "thank you, Macaulay." But one day she surprised me, because her reply, so soft that I thought I misheard it, was, "Me too, Macaulay." Close enough. I was thrilled. During this time, I had started a new novel, The Covenant of Water, set in Kerala. Mom was delighted to help, sharing stories and answering my questions. Sometimes she'd ring me up to recount an anecdote, forgetting she'd shared the same story the previous day. But Mom had a new routine now. When we wound down the call, she'd say, "You haven't said the magic words." When I did, she'd reply, her voice melting, "Me too, Macaulay." I marveled at the way our relationship had turned on its head. Of her three sons, I'd been the most rebellious, causing her much anxiety. But now, I was the one worrying about her, and with good reason. At 90, she became quite frail. Every goodbye felt so poignant. I'd often feel overcome after I visited her. She was well, but I knew one day it would change, and it did. Mom passed away in 2016. Dad now lives with my older brother and his wife in Boston. I often pass by the apartment on Alma Street where they lived. I glance up to the third floor window where Mom would sit looking out. I say those magic words that charmed her. "I love you, Mom," and I hear her say, "Me too, Macaulay." Our next article is in the wellness section. Is anxiety contagious? It's more like catching a bad vibe than a virus, says psychologists, but you still feel lousy. Here's how to boost your defenses. Picture this. You're feeling perfectly calm, cool, and collected when a coworker pops up at your desk like a prairie dog and unleashes a tornado of high-strung thoughts and stressors. You weather the storm till she leaves, only to realize you now have zero chill because your own cortisol has kicked in like crazy. Sound familiar? When other people come and dump that energy, they leave you holding this very emotionally reactive bag of stuff, says psychologist and Therapy for Black Girls founder Joy Harden Bradford, PhD. And now you're forced to deal with it. There's brain science behind this phenomenon. Say you're in a room with somebody who's really anxious. It activates our amygdala, the emotion center of our brain responsible for anxiety, says Elizabeth Fedrick, PhD, an Arizona-based therapist and relationship expert. The tricky part is that the amygdala doesn't know the difference between perceived threats or real ones. If we're watching somebody be really stressed out about something, that part of our brain is alerting us, hey, there's potential danger because if they're worried, then there's probably something to be worried about. In other words, if you see a building on fire, your brain goes directly into the fight or flight response. If you're with someone in the throes of a mental flare-up, your brain assumes they see an actual fire and responds accordingly, releasing a bunch of biochemicals: adrenaline, cortisol, neorepinephrine, so we literally feel it in our body. Here are three ways to buffer yourself from someone else's bad vibes. Move your body. Walk around your office or go outside and get some fresh air, says Bradford. When we do any kind of physical activity, there are neurotransmitters and hormones that rise or fall in our system and help us to regulate. Cassie Holmes, PhD, a UCLA professor and author of Happier Hour, adds, "Exercise is so effective at offsetting anxiety, and so is meditation," she says. "It quiets external influences and uncertainty, and it pulls you into the here and now." Meditation isn't the only way to be in the moment. Bradford relies on a helpful exercise called 5-4-3-2-1. Look around your surroundings for five things you can see, four things you can touch, three things you can hear, two things you can smell, and one thing you can taste, she says. That might include your laptop, the ding of an email notification, and a sip of lukewarm coffee, but simply activating your senses can be incredibly powerful. A lot of times, what's happening with anxiety is that we're either worried about the future or stressed about something that happened in the past, Bradford explains. This grounding exercise is designed to connect you to the present, so anxiety cannot exist. Inoculate yourself from the future attacks. The simplest way is to set boundaries. We are so worried about etiquette that we often allow people to violate our peace because we don't want to be impolite, says Frederick. but it's a crucial element of protecting ourselves from others' anxiety. Putting parameters around how much time we spend with the people who make us feel this way and what we talk about makes a difference. It's also about regaining control, since anxiety comes from feeling like we're not in control, Fedrick says. Assess what you can do to feel more empowered, so you can stay regulated, even if the person across from you is not. In fact, she adds, feel free to interrupt. Even cutting them off like, ugh, I'm sorry you're having such a hard time, is okay. Then redirect the conversation. This article is in the relationship section, How Not to Nag, a 6-step program. A mother of teenagers ponders the impossible, getting things done without screaming endlessly into the void. If you want to get a group of women talking, just ask them if they nag to get things done at home. Yes, I do, and I hate that I do. Don't we have to? Because nothing else would happen otherwise. The more I nag, the less they do. My mom still nags me, and I'm 50. Nag? I've never needed to, said no one ever. Needless to say, women are still the primary naggers in the household. Men are sharing more of the housework than they used to, but females in heterosexual relationships remain more likely to be responsible for the laundry, cleaning, and cooking, according to a 2019 Gallup poll. And there's also cognitive labor, which refers to the time and energy spent finding a tutor for AP Bio, remembering the birthday of every extended family member, and calling the vet because the dog is throwing up again. This work of organizing a family's life is also called the mental load. It can be heavy indeed. And, according to a 2019 paper in the American Sociological Review by Allison Damminger, then a PhD candidate at Harvard University, more of it is shouldered by women than men. Nagging doesn't apply to just school-age kids, teens, and partners either. It's taking young people today longer to become adults in the conventional sense of the word than it did in previous generations, says Lawrence Steinberg, PhD, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Temple University in Philadelphia, and author of the new book, You and Your Adult Child. In other words, there's a good chance your kids will live at home for a few years in their 20s before becoming financially independent. Some friction is natural, but nagging isn't going to get them standing up on their 2 feet any faster. If you're feeling ignored or unsupported by members of your household, or seeing red when you get in the car and the gas light is on, try to remember that nagging more isn't the best solution for getting the tank filled, or the best thing for your relationships with your loved ones. When all they hear is nagging, they may tune you out, which only leads to more, you guessed it. Worse, says Lynn Saladino, PSYD, a clinical psychologist in New York City, nagging can build resentment on both sides. Here, she and other experts give advice on breaking the cycle. Start with you. While you may feel justified in your repeated asks, take a step back before doubling down. Here are some questions to ask yourself and more effective approaches depending on the answers. Are you worried about the chore or something more? Sometimes it's not actually the task. It's more like, I want to know what I have a partner who's going to help me or kids that respect me, says Saladino. When a chore goes undone, many women take it personally, thinking, I've asked them to do it. They have not done it. They've disobeyed and disrespected me, explains Charmaine F. Jackman, Ph.D., licensed psychologist and founder of the national-based directory InnoPsych, which helps match people of color with therapists of color. It's really important to depersonalize that, she says. Take the emotion out of the situation and leave it at, okay, they did not do this. To address someone's lack of behavior communications is key. In a calm moment, not mid-nag, try saying to your family members, I know this might seem silly to you, but you are truly going to make me feel so much better if you put your laundry away, walk the dog, unload the dishwasher. You may want to share some vulnerability, says Saladino, especially if you have anxiety around unfinished tasks. Let's say you and your partner like to watch a show after dinner, but you can't enjoy it unless the kitchen is cleaned up first. Try. I'll be able to relax more if the dishes are done. This is something that could really help me. If you have a bigger issue with your other half that's breaking through in anger about taking out the recycling, Saladino suggests going after the bigger thing. You might say, "Hey, I know I can be naggy when I'm anxious, but I'm having trouble trusting you right now. Can we actively work on that?" Are you flexible or rigid in what you ask for and expect of others? Maybe your partner will fold the towels, but not right now, and not in the clearly superior way you do it, in thirds, of course. Conflict and nagging often help when people don't do things when or how you would like. Ask yourself how crucial or urgent a task and how it's executed actually is. Really challenge yourself, says Jackman. There's an element of control in thinking your way is the only way. What's more important, that the towels are folded or that they're folded in the way you think is right? If it's really important to you, she says, maybe take that task on and give something else over. How often are you giving critical feedback to family members? How often are you bringing joy into their lives? If nagging and criticism are your love languages, something's got to give. Jackman encourages you to remember that it's okay to not be perfect. A pile of backpacks and sneakers by the door and chip crumbs on the kitchen island might mean your teen is comfortable having friends over to hang out. Try to enjoy those moments. The cleanup can wait. Rally the troops. Okay, now that you've done some work on yourself, it's time to get your family on board. Don't just nag, listen. Rather than assuming it's about you, it's probably not. Find out why someone is delaying a task. Maybe your child is nervous about asking a teacher for a college recommendation. Or if they often forgot to text you when they reach your friend's house, it's probably because they get easily distracted when seeing their pal, and setting a reminder on their phone will help. Or the 20-something playing video games is taking a little downtime to de-stress before a Zoom interview. Ask what's going on before reacting. Saladino often hears from people whose partners are avoiding doctor appointments or other aspects of their health. And in this case, getting to the root of the problem is crucial. People might be nervous about the dentist because of a past experience, worried about the expense, or fearful about what medical tests might reveal. If this person is usually proactive and they're being resistant, you might try saying, "You know, I'm going to sleep better at night when you take care of this," or ask, "How can I help you with this?" Get everyone's buy-in. Once you're on a nag-a-thon or you lose your temper, it's hard to get a message across, no matter how valid. Nobody does well when they're angry, says Steinberg. If a particular task is a repeated source of stress and nagging, Steinberg suggests collaborative problem-solving, a technique borrowed from the business world that simply means working together to find a solution. For example, if you're engaged in the age-old debate of whether a teen needs to keep their room clean, sit down together and discuss it. You might say, "The problem is that when your clothes are all over the floor and there are dirty dishes on your desk, it's not just messy, it's unhygienic. So let's see if we can figure out a way we can solve this problem together." Both of you make suggestions until you have a solution. In this case, maybe it's that dishes come to the kitchen every night and clothes have to be picked up by Wednesday nights so the floor can be vacuumed on Thursday. Family meetings can help you stay ahead of problems, says Jackman. Once a week, like over dinner, spend a few minutes talking about how things are going and what's coming up on the calendar. You might say to your kids, "This is your responsibility, your job in the home. What do you have going on this week so you can squeeze it all in? Let's figure it out." Look at the list with your partner, too, and divide and conquer so you're both clear on who's doing what. Play to both of your strengths. Some people prefer carpooling to cooking. Others are better at masterminding a to-do list than executing the items on it. Roll with the punches. Be clear about what's expected, but build in a little flexibility, especially with school-age kids. They aren't necessarily ignoring you out of disrespect. Their priorities just aren't the same as yours. Encourage cooperation by saying, for example, if you want to take the car on Saturday night, you need to mow the lawn first. Kids should know your expectations. But don't throw things in at the last minute because you'll lose their trust. A game plan is particularly important with young adults who have moved back home. Make that before they move back home. Do they have a section of the fridge for their own food, or is everything communal and they help with the grocery shopping? Anticipate as much as you can, and when the inevitable conflicts arise, don't just lay down the law. Try that collaborative problem-solving approach. When both parties have some input into the solution, says Steinberg, they are much more likely to be enthusiastic about implementing it. We're back in books, and this is The Upside of Envy. Elise Lohinen, the podcaster and author of On Our Best Behavior, shares how to free ourselves from the shame of envy and discover its unrecognized advantages. She's just jealous of you. As children, we're often fed this line whenever we complain of mistreatment by another child, usually a girl. It's not you, it's her. She can't control that green-eyed monster within her that wants to bring you down. I don't remember thinking about the truth of this excuse much when I was young. I was happy to take this leap of logic. That girl who mocked me on the playground probably was jealous of me. While this assessment was never interrogated for accuracy, it did provide an easy emotional band-aid. In our culture, we conflate jealousy and envy, even though there's a critical difference between the two words. Jealousy is not between two people. It requires a third. This might show up as someone in pursuit of the same date to the prom, or a sibling who gets more time and attention from a parent, or a coworker who has a better relationship with your boss. Jealousy is about fear and threat of loss, and there's typically a reasonable target. It's a word that gets a lot of use. Jealousy feels natural and understandable, even respectable. Sometimes we throw it at each other as a loose, passive-aggressive compliment to disguise our own dismay. Your husband bought you earrings for your birthday instead of a coffee maker? I'm so jealous. You went to Hawaii? I'm so jealous. Your kids happily read books without being coerced? I'm so jealous. Some couples even like the friction jealousy creates to be reminded that their partner is objectively attractive and can be swept away by someone else. Envy, on the other hand, is unsavory. We think of it as malicious and largely unconscious. It's also intimate and one-to-one. Someone has something or is doing something that you would like for yourself. Maybe a friend announces her engagement while you've struck out on yet another blind date, or is having a baby after you've experienced a series of miscarriages. Maybe someone else got the job you thought was yours, or is succeeding in a way that minimizes your own accomplishments. Your envy in those situations is painful, and as we learned from fairy tales like Snow White, the ultimate insidious tale of intergenerational envy, envy is so powerful and bad, it might motivate someone to have you killed so they can eat your heart. While we're generally accepting of jealousy in relationships, love will make you do crazy things. We can barely tolerate the wash of shame that comes from envy. I'm so envious doesn't really roll off the tongue. It sounds malevolent. Brené Brown explains in her book, Atlas of the Heart, that envy is typically armed with hostility and deprecation. I want that, and I don't want you to have it. I also want you to be pulled down and put down. This might sound extreme, but I believe it's accurate. The way we apprehend envy currently does not make it palatable or acceptable. In the spring of 2019, I interviewed psychotherapist and author Lori Gottlieb. I always say to people, follow your envy. It tells you what you want, Gottlieb explains. Instead of sitting there saying, oh, I wish I had what that person has, and then denigrating them to make yourself feel better, say, What is this telling me, and how can I get it? This conversation was the first time I had heard envy discussed in this way. And I asked if, in her experience, women and men experience envy differently. And she replied it was a mixed bag with a subtle but significant distinction. Envy for women is countered by an immediate unregistered wash of shame. Gottlieb believes women usually reserve their undiagnosed envy for other women, as opposed to men, and especially those who are most like them. I feel this tendency acutely. Men who are doing big things in the world don't trigger much emotion in me, but women are something else entirely, particularly women who occupy the same lanes I swim in. But it wasn't until my conversation with Gottlieb that I started to acknowledge the truth of this to myself and realized how bad it makes me feel. I ran through this thought like a car wash over the following months, trying it on. When I found myself sending an eyebrow up in my own dismay, irritation, resentment, judgment about another woman's outfit, Instagram post, or parenting, I deliberated. Is this envy coming out sideways? Is this envy that I'm too embarrassed to acknowledge? I also began to contemplate what it meant that envy, so maligned, shameful, hard to admit, could be something good. Because it requires us to own our wanting. Envy is the fulcrum or hinge for desire, the first expression of agency. Want is an essential verb. This compulsion to get our needs met, to wish for opportunity and excitement, drives us forward. It's the initial step on the path to asserting yourself. Envy tests our tolerance for watching other people get what they want and reminds us of what we've been too afraid to pursue. I could not shake this idea, wondering whether it was some sort of key. I also realized that repression of envy runs so deep, even when I went actively digging for it, I frequently missed its cues. I was oblivious to the ways in which envy operated inside of me. I would find myself telling my husband all the seemingly valid reasons I didn't like someone, only to realize that I had, again, missed the point. Oh, she's not pretentious. I'm envious her grade schoolers are doing high school level math and winning art fairs. Oh, she's not a sellout. I'm envious she's achieving more than me in the world and is always on vacation in romantic, far-flung locales. I thought about this idea of wanting opportunities and experiences for ourselves just because we want them, and how deeply we bury this in our subconscious. I thought about how shameful it is for women to express desire in all parts of our lives, and how many of us would rather clip the bud of our ambition than experience the humiliation of being exposed for thinking we're worthy of adding something meaningful to the world. We recognize wanting is dangerous, for ourselves and for each other. Because when we disparage the other, it just might be because we want what she has. But when that longing is not reacted to but studied, it can be a lighthouse for your heart's desire, shedding its rays on purpose and potential. Parts of this article were edited due to time. In TV and movies, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle speak out about their interview with Oprah. The former royals open up in their new Netflix special. Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's docuseries, Harry and Meghan, is now streaming in full on Netflix. And in the last three episodes, the former royals reveal a few little-known things about their interview with Oprah. The two sat down with Oprah in 2021, about a year after they officially exited the royal family. During the interview, they shared some jaw-dropping moments from their tumultuous time in England. From the royal family questioning what Archie's skin tone would be like, to Meghan explaining that she had sunk into a deep depression, the conversation rocked the foundation the monarchy is built on. In Harry and Meghan, the pair first note that they first met Oprah when she stopped by Nottingham Cottage, their home in England. After revealing the small size of the cottage, Harry and Meghan shared Oprah's take on their space. "Oprah came over for tea, didn't she?" Harry asked. "And when she came in, she sat down and goes, 'No one would ever believe it,'" Megan replies. Oprah had originally reached out to us through the communications director when we were at Kensington Palace, Megan says. "There was excitement, I remember that." Harry takes that opportunity to chime in, noting that Oprah was someone special for Megan, to which she replies simply, "It's Oprah." Eventually, after they broke from the family, Harry and Megan agreed to the interview. "Sitting down with Oprah was a reaction to what had happened that year," Harry says. Yet, just days before the interview aired, Buckingham Palace opened an investigation into a bullying claim against Megan. According to former palace spokesman James Holt, who was interviewed throughout the docuseries, that timing was not accidental. "It was done explicitly because of the Oprah interview," he says. "That interview, it was less about setting the record straight than at least filling in the blanks that other people were filling in for us," Megan says. "The more distance that came between us having a smaller role with the institution, coming over here, the more of a vacuum was being built. People just genuinely didn't understand why we left." Oprah helped Harry and Megan expose some of the injustices found within the palace walls, but the public perception still surprised Megan. "I thought that me being very open about the depression that I experienced and just how extreme that became, I thought that would be the biggest takeaway," she says. "But it was entirely eclipsed by the conversation surrounding race." In the Netflix docuseries, Harry and Megan are shown viewing the Oprah interview for the very first time. "We didn't see it until the world saw it," Megan reveals. "Luckily, their closet supporters were there for them, and, as the docuseries notably shows, that support included a check-in from Beyoncé herself, well before Prince William reached out. 'She wants me to feel safe and protected. She admires and respects my bravery and vulnerability, and she thinks I was selected to break generational curses that need to be healed,'" Megan says of Beyoncé's message to her. And the couple was grateful to Oprah for being part of their conversation. "Thank you both for trusting me to share your story," Oprah said when the interview wrapped up. "Thank you for giving us the space to do it," Megan replied. We're in lifestyle now. The article is Introvert or Extrovert? 6 Ways to Tell Which Personality Type You Are. This personality distinction can tell you so much about you and your relationship with others. There are so many ways to categorize our personalities these days. Of course, there's the breakdown of the big 3 in astrology, sun, rising, and moon signs, and there are Enneagram personality quizzes all over the internet that can give you insight into how you interact with others and when you're alone. But one of the most basic personality assessments can be broken down into just 2 words, introverts and extroverts. You're probably familiar with these words, and maybe even can guess which of the 2 you fall into more or know which one someone else identifies with. But there's so much more beneath the surface of these 2 descriptors. We're usually quick to assume those who are talkative, sociable, and filled with energy are extroverted. However, it's possible that you can love socializing and be an introvert at heart. With that said, we sat down with some therapists to get the lowdown on introverts and extroverts, including the differences and how to tell which category you may fall into if you don't already know or are unsure. Traits of an introvert. "There are so many myths surrounding the traits of an introvert," says Anita Astley, a psychotherapist, relationship expert, and author. "Introverts are often misunderstood and are experienced as being shy, antisocial, and self-centered," says Astley. "In actuality, introverts do not fear people or socializing with people. Rather, they prefer to limit their interaction time and enjoy intimate gathering over large ones." Leah Charnin, a licensed psychologist and founder of Change Well Psych, adds that since introverts are so aware of their inner world, they have a great capacity to speak with thoughtful intention, which can be beneficial for honing relationships. When it comes to making decisions, introverts tend to focus on their internal thoughts and feelings rather than external forces, says Astley. This is why they are known to be quieter than extroverts. Instead of talking things out with another person, they prefer to spend time alone to come to their own conclusions. One of the many strengths is that introverts make great active listeners, says Astley. Traits of an extrovert. Extroverts are often social, talkative, optimistic, outgoing, gregarious, friendly, and willing to take risks, says Nancy Collier, psychotherapist, public speaker, and author of The Emotionally Exhausted Woman. Unlike introverts, when they are going through a problem or issue, they are more inclined to talk it out with others than internalize and keep it inward, says Astley. They easily express their thoughts, feelings, and opinions and are action-oriented. With that said, being an extrovert may have its costs in many scenarios. For example, since extroverts are fast processors, they may unintentionally say embarrassing things that result in a need for relational repair, says Charnin. How to identify whether you're an introvert or an extrovert? Although there are many distinctive traits of both introverts and extroverts, the source of these different personalities is where they get their energy from. Introverts recharge their batteries by spending time alone, while extroverts recharge by spending time with others. Astley recommends asking yourself the following questions if you need more help deciding which you are. Are you drained, introverts, or energized, extroverts, by social interaction? Do you prefer to socialize in large groups, extroverts, or small groups, introverts? When you're trying to solve a problem, do you need to mostly talk it out, extroverts, or think it out, introverts? Do you prefer more social time, extroverts, or alone time, introverts? Would you describe yourself as the life of the party, extroverts, or more of a quiet, active listener, drawing inward rather than outward, introverts? Do you easily introduce yourself to people when walking into a room full of unfamiliar faces, extroverts, or avoid it if you can and wait for others to come to you, introverts? Charnin adds, considering these additional questions to help figure out if you're an introvert or extrovert. Do you seek external validation often, extroverts, or process internally, introvert? Have you received feedback that you speak with harshness or without thinking, extrovert, or that you need to speak more, introvert? Do you prefer to work with groups, extroverts, or alone, introvert? How to cope with social situations as an introvert or extrovert? Just because extroverts are the more social of the two personalities doesn't mean they are always successful at socializing. For example, situations such as holidays can be a stressful time for both introverts and extroverts. So here are a few tips for each to make social settings a bit smoother. Introverts. Collier says one of the best things an introvert can do for themselves is to give themselves permission to be who they are. They can do this by simply acknowledging that they are wired to get more burned out in social situations, and that's okay. It removes the shame and blame they can put themselves through because socializing is hard, says Collier. It's really all about acceptance of our own nature. Taking a few minutes to yourself in the form of a bathroom break is a great way for introverts to recharge if you're feeling a bit too overstimulated, recommends Astley. Additionally, Charnin adds that it's important for introverts to identify their strengths since they have a tendency to internalize negative stereotypes. Self-compassion toward their social nature is critical to increasing acceptance of their hardwired introverted nature, says Charnin. Permit yourself to set social time limits. Extroverts. Challenge yourself to pause more in conversations to increase the comfort of silence and give others more space to speak, says Charnin. Social situations are where extroverts shine. so remember to have some fun along the way with it. Additionally, Charnin recommends spending time alone to build tolerance for it, increasing self-validation, and exploring ways you enjoy your own company. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Okay, in case you'd like to do some baking, we're moving over to the food section. This is called Bake a Batch of These Yummy Brownie Cookies. You'll love this recipe from Magnolia Table, Volume 3 by Joanna Gaines. These delicious cookies are a bestseller at the bakery. They have a soft rise and just the right amount of gooiness. We are a house divided when it comes to cookies versus brownies, so this two-for-one combination is an easy win for everyone. Okay, it makes 35 cookies. The prep time is 25 minutes, and the cook time is 35 minutes. And then you should let them cool 1 hour and 25 minutes. And here are the ingredients. 2.5 cups of semi-sweet chocolate chips, 8 tablespoons or 1 stick of unsalted butter, 1 cup of all-purpose flour, 2 tablespoons of Dutch processed cocoa powder, 1 teaspoon of baking powder, 1/2 teaspoon of kosher salt, 3 large eggs, 1 cup granulated sugar, 1/3 of a cup of packed light brown sugar, and 2 teaspoons of pure vanilla extract. Here are the directions. Step 1. In a medium microwave safe bowl, combine 2 cups of the chocolate chips and the butter. Microwave on high in 20-second intervals, stirring thoroughly between intervals until the mixture is completely melted and smooth. Scrape the chocolate mixture into the bowl of a stand mixer fitted with the paddle attachment and let sit at room temperature for 20 minutes to cool. Step 2. While the chocolate mixture is cooling, sift together the flour, cocoa, baking powder, and salt in a separate medium bowl. Preheat the oven to 370 degrees Fahrenheit and line 2 large baking sheets with parchment paper. Step 3. Add the eggs, granulated sugar, brown sugar, and vanilla to the cooled chocolate mixture and beat on medium speed until thoroughly combined. Reduce the speed to low and slowly pour the flour mixture into the chocolate mixture and mix until all the ingredients are thoroughly combined. Add the remaining 1/2 cup of chocolate chips and mix briefly to incorporate fully. Step 4. Using a 1-ounce scoop, portion the dough onto 1 prepared baking sheet. You do not need to space them out. Chill until firm, about 45 minutes. Step 5. Working in batches, place the chilled cookies 2 inches apart on the other prepared room temperature baking sheet. Step 6. Bake until the edges are set, 12 to 14 minutes. The centers of the cookies will appear and feel soft when hot, but will set as they cool. Let cool on the baking sheet 5 minutes and then transfer to a wire rack to cool completely. Repeat with the remaining cookie balls. Step 7. Store in an airtight container for up to 5 days. Okay, this article is in relationships. It says prenups aren't just for rich people, and they don't mean your marriage is doomed either. Here are 3 prenup myths that marital and legal experts are dying to debunk. Getting married. Isn't it romantic? When you're fussing over diamond clarity grades and which shade of peonies will pop against your bridesmaid dresses, chances are the last thing on your mind is, who will get the mini schnauzer and my 401k if my husband has an affair with his chiropractor years from now? Yes, drafting a prenup is the Ebenezer Scrooge of premarital decisions. But marital therapists and matrimonial lawyers universally agree that it's critical for couples to talk about money and carefully consider the pros and cons of formally agreeing on how they will divide up assets in the event of a divorce before they get married. Think of it as an insurance plan you will hopefully never need, says NYC matrimonial lawyer Ettrick Campbell. Generally speaking, it's a lifesaver for both people if the relationship goes sour. Yes, he says, even the partner with fewer assets, because it spells out exactly how issues of custody and equitable distribution will be resolved without subjecting either party to a long, drawn-out, expensive court case. Without a valid prenup, any financial settlements will be governed by the divorce lawyers of the state where you live, says NYC divorce lawyer Robert Cohen. This can be both good and bad, depending on your bank accounts. In most states, the law is quite generous to the untitled spouse, the one with significantly fewer assets and income. For example, New York State prohibits people from completely disinheriting a spouse. That means that even if you cut your significant other out of your will, perhaps you're splitting up and want all your money to go to your kids from a first marriage. Your spouse would still have a legal right to one-third of your estate, regardless of whether you have kids together. Ultimately, a prenup can be empowering, says psychologist and relationship expert Judith Rabinor, PhD author of How to Befriend Your Ex After Divorce. I've seen it actually bring couples closer by forcing them to talk about the hard stuff and be really authentic and open with each other. We asked the experts to dispel some of the other common misconceptions people harbor about prenuptial agreements. Grab a mug, here comes the tea. Assumption number one, I will seem money hungry or stingy if I bring this up. Truth. Leading the convo with love can strengthen your relationship. Experts say the best way to avoid a negative impression is to lead with a more neutral topic. Marriage, after all, is about sharing a life, not just cash. Start by talking about something other than finances, suggests Campbell, like, if we ever get divorced, who will take the dog? What would we do with the children? Or, hey, I want to make sure we have adequate life insurance for Billy. Another possible way in is, I understand that your mother and I don't have the greatest relationship, but I want to make sure that if anything were to ever happen to us, she would still be in our children's lives. Rabinor believes it is also important to acknowledge how sensitive the topic is and assure your fiancé that it is nothing to do with doubts you have about your relationship. She offers this script. I don't want to be a downer, because I intend to be married to you for the rest of my life. But I wanted to bring up something that has crossed my mind recently. What would happen if I quit my job to raise our kids and then we got a divorce? The more you couch the conversation in loving terms that show your desire for a deeper, more authentic connection, the better she says. Obviously, the specifics of the conversation will vary depending on whether it is a first, second, or third marriage. But one tip Rabinor suggests is referencing a prior experience that impressed upon you the importance of financial transparency. Perhaps it was a childhood fraught with financial instability, or a previous partner who blew all your savings on a secret gambling habit. It's really about your partnership and talking through the reality of how you will work together as a team to accomplish your dream and you mutually support each other, she says. Assumption number two. Marriage is about love and romance, period. Truth. Marriage is an emotional and financial partnership. While many folks get swept away by the great dopamine rush of falling in love, there is a whole practical financial side of marriage that people often never even talk about, says Rabinor. A prenup forces you and your future spouse to talk about money in a way that's very open and transparent, and that's critical to the long-term viability of your marriage. The more authentic you are as a couple, the more likely it is that you'll be able to deal with the hard stuff that eventually comes up in all relationships. The hard stuff doesn't just go away because you don't talk about it. Indeed, study after study shows that the inability to see eye to eye on money issues plays a huge role in long-term marital success. So wouldn't you prefer to peel that back that onion before it becomes a sludgy, rotten mess in the bottom of your fridge? According to a study published in Couple Family Psychology, at least one spouse is 55.6% of couples seeking to dissolve their marriage cited financial problems as a major contributor to divorce. As for timing, Cohen recommends drafting a prenup at least 6 months before your wedding. even before you put down deposits on the music or venue. This gives you ample time to compare financial goals and values, a bond-building exercise that marital therapists like Rabinor can facilitate. Gather a list of assets, draft a plan, and review it with a lawyer, a process that, believe it or not, can bring you even closer together. Leaving this sensitive task to the last minute is highly discouraged. Many states require a prenup to be delivered in advance, generally 30 days for the document to be viable, says Cohen. And others, like New York, don't have strict laws deadlines. But if you wait until the last minute, your partner will likely feel betrayed and upset, possibly derailing your union altogether. Campbell believes women should bring it up even earlier in a relationship if they are at a stage in life where they know they want to get married. After all, he says, who wants to waste 3 years in a relationship that could implode the moment the conversation turns to the P word? I don't think it's ever too early, he says. Assumption number 3, only rich people need prenups. Truth, countless other circumstances can warrant one. People think prenups only deal with finances, but many don't realize they can resolve issues such as equitable distribution, child custody, and even whether a spouse can disparage their partner on social media, says Campbell. A good prenup will take into account what each party brings to the relationship. So let's say someone is marrying a billionaire, and they mutually decide that it's better for their marriage if the non-billionaire forgoes going back to school or pursuing a career. A prenup can essentially compensate that person for that. Prenups are also a good idea for people who may not be wealthy now, but stand to inherit a significant amount of money. Inherited money that is kept separate from marital assets in a separate account or a trust fund is generally safe, says Cohen. But what happens if, say, one partner decides to take some of their inheritance and invest it in a down payment on a marital home? The law gets a little more gray there, says Cohen. If it's commingled, it's generally considered a joint marital property. A few other reasons non-wealthy people may want to consider a prenup: the existence of kids from a previous marriage, a significant discrepancy in retirement savings or accrued debt, different spending habits, and any serious habit or problem that can lead to a dissolution of marital assets, like gambling or substance abuse. Bottom line, while everyone wants to enter a marriage with a sense of optimism, many of us need to reframe the way we think about prenups. Instead of seeing them as admissions of doubt, Rabinor encourages her clients to view them as a part of a larger conversation about merging and independence. It's a book recommendation for preteens and teens. This is My Perfect Life by Lynda Barry, and Lynda is spelled L-Y-N-D-A. The new thing at my school is for you to be yourself. I don't get what that is even supposed to mean. What do you do in case yourself really sucks? So asks freckled, myopically challenged middle schooler Maybon Mullen of her own reflection in the mirror, one of a series of honest, funny, sad, deep, and daffy confessions in cartoonist Barry's collection. Collected from her iconic strip Ernie Pook's Comeek, and that's C-O-M-E-E-K, the collection focuses on Maybon, the self-doubting and sensitive older sister of exuberant Marlies, over one rocky year. Maybon experiences bullying, a cruddy first boyfriend, family drama, drinking, and suicidal thoughts. Though Barry never shies away from the darkness of Maybon's life, the cartoons are full of life, vigor, off-kilter humor, and luminescent humanity. Barry's bold all-caps hand lettering and wonky black-and-white drawings go straight to your heart. The total picture of Maybon's intense year is one of the most unforgettable and unflinchingly real portrayals of adolescence ever published. Another book rec for young adults is Planet Middle School by Nikki Grimes. Nikki is N-I-K-K-I. In this unassuming little gem of a book written in free verse, 12-year-old tomboy Jolin enters middle school, where everything that had formerly been safe and familiar, her two best friends, her confidence on the basketball court, her very own body, immediately spins out of control. I swear, some days I feel like an alien, dropped off on Planet Middle School by mistake. I keep scanning the skies, searching for that spaceship that's gonna take me home. Even the most reluctant readers will be hooked from the start, thanks to Joy's relatable voice and Grimes's simple, direct language, which speeds along. The whole book is just 160 pages, and some of the chapters are just 3 lines long. Joy's family is loving and supportive, and the story never gets very dark or graphic, making it ideal for the youngest readers. Under award-winning books you might want to read, Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver, the co-winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the 98th selection of Oprah's Book Club, introduces us to the story of Demon, a young boy born to a teenage mother in Virginia who falls victim to a scourge of opioid addiction spreading throughout Appalachia. Kingsolver's latest book grabbed me from its opening lines, said Oprah. I so admire the way Barbara has taken the plight of a young boy and invited us on his journey through loss, the foster system, addiction, and so much more. The novel speaks to so many of our country's relevant issues, but most importantly, it's absolutely riveting, an instant American classic, says Wadzane Mute, M-H-U-T-E. Another book is Trust by Hernan Diaz, D-I-A-Z. Set in New York City in the Roaring Twenties, the other co-winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction brings to life the spectacular fall of the 1929 Wall Street crash. Author Diaz masterfully incorporates 4 different voices. Benjamin Rask, a financier who makes a fortune from the collapse, Andrew Bevel, a Wall Street tycoon, the writer, Ida Partenza, and Bevel's wife. Each viewpoint challenges the reader's understanding of the truth, creating a world that seems more real than fiction, exposing the wealthy classes and interweaving narratives, says Wadzane Mute. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.